everybody. Thank you for being here. This is our second to last digital dialogue of the semester, so savor these moments. I do, however, have a couple announcements about how we're going to wrap up the season, some exciting new developments. So you heard from Kyle Bickoff, who is our Whittemore Dissertation Fellow, and he will be closing out our digital dialogue season next week with talking about his fellowship work. And we're also very pleased that following Kyle's digital dialogue on Wednesday, April 17th, we will host an additional event called Out of the Box, Enlarging Our Understanding of Containers and Storage Media. And that'll be a conversation between Kyle, Robert Sunderman, Mary Alexander, and professor in the iSchool, Ricky Punzalan. And the topic of the panel is, what can we learn about nature, history, and the future of collections and practices of collecting by focusing our attention on the containers that house them? So this will be a moderated dialogue between a scholar of digital containers, a museum professional with a long history of managing collections and storage facilities, and we'll reflect on this question and many more. So please join us next Wednesday morning. And then finally, our second special event to announce is that Monday, April 29th at 4 p.m., we'll be hosting a book launch and conversation for Dr. Alexis Lothian. She'll be in conversation with Amanda Phillips talking about Alexis's new book, Old Futures, Speculative Fiction and Queer Possibility. That'll be here at 4 p.m. on the 29th, so turn out for that. And you can look out for all those announcements again on our Twitter feed and our website, and we hope to see many of you there. All right, without further delay, it is my pleasure to introduce our digital dialogue speaker today. Christina Boyles is an assistant professor of culturally engaged digital humanities, which is an awesome title, in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures at Michigan State University. Her research explores the relationship between digital humanities, surveillance, social justice, and the environment. Her published work appears in Digital Humanities Quarterly, Bodies of Information, Feminist Debates in the Digital Humanities, American Quarterly, the Southern Literary Journal, the South Central Review, and Plath Profiles. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Boyles.
Thank you for having me today. I'm not going to lie, the job title was one of the major reasons I applied for this job. Pretty amazing. Before I get started today, I want to begin by acknowledging that we are on the grounds of the Piscataway, and I want to note that their historical and ongoing presence in this space affects the kind of communities that we develop here. I find it really important to make these kind of acknowledgments, not only in words, but also as I believe that the core of scholarship for me is about promoting decolonization. So I want to take this as a moment to invite us all to think creatively about how we can implement decolonial strategies into our research, teaching, and service. And this is particularly important for me in my work in Puerto Rico as I look at the ways we can decolonize disaster response. My title for my presentation I've tweaked just a little, but I promise I'm still going to talk about all of the terrors of disaster capitalism today. So the refreshed title is Decolonizing Disaster, Climatizing Surveillance in Post-Maria Puerto Rico. And today's refrain is that the goal of surveillance is erasure. Now, this can be a bit surprising for many of us. Often we start off learning about surveillance by studying Foucault's theorization of panopticism. In this theory, we know that there's a guard in the central tower, and that person can see everything. In fact, all the individuals in the prison are divided into individualized cells so that they can be monitored more closely. The theory is that the guard doesn't even need to be in the tower for everyone to obey the structures of the surveillance ecosystem. But what we often don't hear about are the invisible mechanisms underlying the surveillance ecology, right? Who is in the tower? How did they get there? Who is holding the prison, and what kind of values or oppressive strategies do they use for the people who are inside? We're seeing this as a new trend in surveillance studies, uncovering what has previously been invisible. And there are a number of great texts that do this. So I want to give a shout out just to a few. The first is Sophia Noble's Algorithms of Oppression, where she looks at the ways in which Google's search algorithm discriminates against Black women and girls. The second is an article by Miriam Posner called See No Evil, which looks at the ways in which supply chains operations are intentionally kept invisible, even by different organizations along the supply chain, so as to further the exploitation of human life and bodies. The third is Virginia Eubanks' Automating Inequality, which looks at the ways in which social services have been shifted from a human-centric approach to an algorithmic approach. And she points out the ways in which this furthers discrimination against the most marginalized and at-risk populations. But for the sake of my work, perhaps the most important is Simone Brown, who wrote Dark Matters on the Surveillance of Blackness. In this text, she defines surveillance as something that can be understood through the lens of blackness itself, defining this as racializing surveillance, which she cites as a technology of social control where surveillance practices, policies, and performances concern the productions of norms pertaining to race and exercise a power to define what is in or out of place. So an extension of her argument would say that in the United States, in a public space, people who are deemed to be racially different are surveyed in different ways. And we can see this all the time in the ways in which people are treated as objects of to be welcomed or to be feared. We know this with policing practices, or even the ways in which individuals get followed around department stores. Right? I find this framework particularly useful in Puerto Rico because racializing surveillance is also applicable on the island. Many of the people who are most discriminated against and most marginalized identify as Taino, a member of the indigenous peoples of Puerto Rico, as Afro-Puerto Rican, or as a recent immigrant to the island, particularly from the Dominican Republic. And we're seeing this play out in significant ways post-Hurricane Maria. But I think we also need to think of a way to talk about this particular unique moment. And so I offer us the term climatizing surveillance, which I term as surveillance methods that are developed, implemented, or rehashed during times of climate catastrophe. One serious example of this that we've seen is the ways in which marginalized communities are being encouraged to maintain private contracts for their infrastructure. A great example of this is how, after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, a contract was given to the Whitefish Corporation to rebuild their electrical infrastructure. Even though Whitefish was located in Montana, had no connection to the island, and only had 3 employees at the time. They had none of the resources needed to be able to complete the task they were being asked to do, but they were connected. Whitefish is closely linked to Ryan Zink, the current director of the EPA, who many of you might know is also closely linked to the Trump administration. Whitefish also, some of its major investors were heavily invested in Trump's campaign as well. We're also seeing traditional surveillance strategies being adapted or acclimated to this new climate environment. The one I'm going to talk about most today is a process of selective documentation, whereas industries and corporations and governments are using legalized documents or official documents as a way to keep people in or out of this disaster recovery process. I find it particularly important to talk about climatizing surveillance in relation to Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico is at the forefront of climate catastrophe. Due to its unique geography, Puerto Rico is expected to experience some of the worst effects of climate change and some of the earliest. Not only is it an island located in the Caribbean, it is the furthest east of all of the islands, and therefore it has no geological structures to protect it from the onslaught of storms. It also, of course, is territory of the United States, and that relationship is complicated for a number of reasons, but not the least being the Jones Act, in which all items that are supposed to go to the island have to be shipped to somewhere on the mainland first, meaning that the supply chain for recovery is quite slow. To give you a little bit of a refresher, since it's been a bit of time since Hurricane Maria passed, I just want to remind you about the severity of the storm, because I think understanding the damages that occurred and the real lived experiences of the people on the island is crucial to us being able to intervene in the harmful disaster response practices that are occurring right now. So Hurricane Maria hit the island as a Category 5 hurricane. It came into the island from the southeast corner, crossed directly through the center of the island, and exited the northwest corner. Because it made such a direct hit, it has affected every single community on the island to some degree, although some certainly fared better than others. It also affected the middle of the island most significantly, and this is the rural region. It's actually quite mountainous here, and so many of these locales can already be difficult to reach even on the best of days. But of course, when supplies were needed, that became increasingly difficult. This map here shows the change in the electrical grid before and after the storm. And the lights you see up top are the four largest cities on the island, San Juan being in the north, Ponce in the south, Caguas over here in the east, and Mayaguez in the west. And you can see that almost all the electrical grid completely drops after the storm. Moreover, most of us know that hurricanes just aren't about the event itself, but about the significant water damage and flooding that occurs afterwards. So here's a picture of the flooding in Puerto Rico. We know that water levels were raised on the island for somewhere between 2 to 5 weeks, depending on which community you were in. And of course, that has significant impacts on people's ability to get supplies, to get medical attention, the spread of disease, as well as, of course, affecting all of these buildings and the infrastructure in the communities. While many of us may have not heard about Puerto Rico recently, it certainly made attention last week when Donald Trump decided to tweet about the disaster recovery process. I want to point to two tweets in particular, although there were many, so you can make the choice to go look for more if you'd so be interested. The first here says, Puerto Rico got $91 billion for their hurricane, more money than has ever been gotten for a hurricane before, and all their local politicians do is complain and ask for more money. The politicians are grossly incompetent, spend the money foolishly or corruptly, and only take from the USA. So I want to unpack this a little bit because it's highly problematic in so many ways. The first is that it's spreading a lot of misinformation. Although Puerto Rico did request $91 billion of aid because they carefully evaluated how much money they would need to recover quickly and effectively, they have only received somewhere between $11 billion and $11.5 billion as of today. And this has been confirmed by a wide variety of sources, including all of the ones listed here. So that'd be El Nuevo Dia, which is the most widely circulated newspaper on the island, the New York Times, National Public Radio, and the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello. In fact, in an interview with NPR last week, Ricardo Rossello noted that only $300,000 of that $11 billion has been able to be applied to building new infrastructure on the island. The rest of the money had to go to immediate disaster response. Essentially then, Puerto Rico has received no money for the rebuilding process. Also, we see some pretty harmful rhetoric here, as Donald Trump seems to be blaming the politicians on the island for the disaster response, even though we know that the money comes from the mainland, right? It is the failure of the government on our end and not necessarily the failure of Puerto Rico. But what Donald Trump is doing here, I argue, is he is participating in this process of erasure, right? He is erasing our responsibility for what is happening in Puerto Rico and making sure that the blame is placed elsewhere in order to justify his policy decisions. And now we can take this one step further by looking at the second tweet that I've included there. Okay? The second one says, the Democrats today killed a bill that would have provided great relief to farmers and yet more money to Puerto Rico, despite the fact that Puerto Rico already has been scheduled to receive more hurricane relief funding than any place in history. So we've already talked about the misinformation. Obviously, they have not received more aid than any other place in history. What I really want to point out here is the way in which place appears in quotation marks, the system of othering the island of Puerto Rico, making it seem like it is not part of this country, but at the same time using rhetoric that claims that it is dependent upon us, right, on the mainland and our generosity to survive. This again feeds into that rhetoric of erasure and also excuses the ways in which many of Trump's friends, such as the owners of Whitefish, are actually seeking out these opportunities to jump onto the island and profit, which I'll talk about more in a few minutes. So my research on Puerto Rico is part of a larger project. Today I'm only going to talk about this framework of climatizing surveillance, but the bigger project is the Maria Memory Bank. I'm working with a number of partners from the University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras and Mayaguez, as well as individuals at the University of the Bahamas, the U.S. National Park Service in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the Turks and Caicos Museum to collect stories from individuals who went through Hurricane Maria throughout the Caribbean and who feel like their stories are not being well represented in the media. We find this particularly important as a way to intervene in the harmful narratives that we're seeing presented in our popular media. And we find it also really important as a way to demonstrate the real hardships of disaster. What you see here is a link to the prototype project, so you can follow this link if you so choose and see a little bit of information about what's happening, as well as a map with some of the interviews embedded on it, although it is a work in progress, so I will caution you that it's not a finalized, polished product. But what I'm going to show you today is a short video of some of the highlights of those interviews, so you can get a sense of what people who went through the storm have experienced.
Cuando llega María, no solamente un segundo huracán en dos semanas, sino que es más fuerte todavía. Así que la experiencia fue terrible porque el huracán devastó en nuestra isla, en nuestras comunidades. Y eso ha tenido consecuencias que son pues, muy nefastas.
It took 3, almost 4 months to get power and almost 3 months to get water.
Fueron muy pocas las agencias que llegaron en el momento que estaba la situación en su punto, como digo yo.
In those first 2-3 weeks, we didn't saw anything. Like, we didn't saw police, we didn't saw the mayor of town, we didn't have nothing. Like, it was just us.
It was hard. Maria was a learning course for everybody.
La mayor parte de lo que ayuda que recibimos fue de la comunidad, de ciudadanos, de organizaciones, de iglesia, nos apoyaron mucho.
I remember when Trump came, he was just like, oh, you only have like, I don't know, 20 people died. And I was like, no, those numbers are not real. But it also has a lot to do with our government, because I don't think they have been as transparent as they could. Because if you would just display the real number of deaths and the real number of damage that was in the island, then you would get the help.
Tan reciente como hace 2 semanas aproximadamente, un vecino de mi barrio intentó suicidarse desde lo alto de una torre de energía eléctrica. Él representó y simbolizó cómo nos sentimos y hasta dónde llega nuestra desesperación luego de 8 meses de estar sin luz todavía, sin servicio de agua.
I'm sure they have all PTSD. Like, if it rains a lot, they're like, they start looking for the river. Like, is it coming up? Like, do we have to go? And that's very scary because you're not saving your own home.
From September up to January, it was 68 dogs that I rescued from this street.
Muchas personas se están yendo del país. El sistema educativo aprovechó el proceso de huracán para cerrar escuelas.
Para mí es bien triste que cada vez que bajo los fines de semana a mi hogar, ver un negocio cerrado, ver un mini mall que tenemos en Yabucoa que solo tiene abierto actualmente una tienda.
Our infrastructures cannot afford another hurricane.
Muchas personas perdieron sus pechos y el que llegaran todos los que se prestan para eso, que usualmente lo presta FEMA, pues ha tardado muchísimo.
Everybody hate Maria. I bet you nobody's put their name to their daughters.
Apologies, I should have given a brief content warning before playing the video. Some of the things that I think the interviewees point out here are the unbelievably harsh circumstances that they faced after the storm. You'll notice that in our media, we didn't really hear about the chain of suicide attempts that occurred on the island, even though there were many throughout generally the most rural areas because they were the last to receive infrastructure. Even on the island of Puerto Rico itself, those were not made prevalent in the media. Many of the people I talked to in additional clips said it was a source of shame for the island and they didn't want that image released about them. Other things that we saw mentioned, particularly by this woman, Ishi Maldonado, is that the death toll was a way of participating in a selective documentation process. So the official death toll for the hurricane was initially 64 lives, and that was developed by government agencies. An independent investigation revealed, however, that they believe now the number is somewhere closer to about 1,300 lives. And this is still not counting the 300 bodies that were mysteriously cremated the week after the storm, who the island's government claims all died from natural causes, as well as the individuals who have lost their lives due to disease that they encountered from floodwaters and the lack of medical services and infrastructure. Right, so I would expect that number to be significantly higher. I'm going to talk a little bit why collective documentation is a problem. I argue that the vulnerabilities created by Hurricane Maria are pivotal to the United States colonial agenda on the island. Using a process of selective documentation, government and corporate entities are participating in a resource grab that will impede the island's well-being for decades. And perhaps no place exemplifies this better than Valle Hill. Valle Hill is a small community in the municipality of Canabanas. It is, or it was originally owned by the Puerto Rican Land Authority and is relegated as a wetland that is not deemed suitable for human life or development. In Canabanas, there is a river that runs through part of the territory, and there's a highland, which is where many individuals live, and then there's this low-lying area in Valle Hill. In previous hurricanes, that area was left empty so that when the waters rose and the floods came, the water would run off all to the low side of the river and not harm any of the human residences. However, 24 years ago, a mayor from the municipality of Canabanas decided that he was gonna come up with a unique way to get votes. And so he decided to sell off parcels of land in Valle Hill for quite cheap. Documentation shows that they sold for as little as $50 per plot of land, and generally not for more than $150. Who do you think was probably interested in this very cheap land? He targeted recent immigrants to the island, particularly those from the Dominican Republic, who wanted to live in a relatively close proximity to the capital, San Juan, which they are, but also did not have the financial resources to do so except for this opportunity. What you can see here is a picture of the community of Valle Hill. This was taken 9 months after the hurricane hit. And so you can see how many roofs still are using tarps as the roofs. And then you can see here that many of these buildings are likely abandoned because it would not be sustainable for human life inside. One of the reasons that they have so little resources during this disaster recovery process is that FEMA came in and was requested to provide aid. And FEMA determined that their titles to their land were not valid. And that is because the land was never deemed to be suitable for human development or use. And so many of these individuals, believing that they had real titles to their property who were able to produce that documentation, were told, I'm sorry, no, that doesn't count. And they had to rely on aid only from local community members and local charitable organizations. This is what Michelle Gilman and Rachel Green call the surveillance gap. There's a group of people in our society who exist outside the surveillance ecosystem, whether that be immigrants, itinerant, the homeless, people whose information isn't housed in the fancy databases. They don't have photo IDs necessarily. They don't have home loans. They're not registered with a college. And as such, they are often invisible to policymakers. Their entire world exists kind of outside the surveillance mechanism. So the surveillance gap, as they note, incurs harm to residents that can be severe, such as physical and mental health injuries and a lack of economic stability, as well as data marginalization and resulting invisibility to policymakers. And that's my emphasis here, as I see that as being particularly prevalent in Puerto Rico. They go on to note that having too much privacy, as these residents in Valle Hill would be deemed to have, can be as injurious as having too little. And that certainly seems to be the case here. Residents of Valle Hill were not the only ones to have their claims to FEMA denied, however. This happened throughout the island, as many claims to property were deemed to be invalid, and as many more deeds had blown away in the storm. FEMA required individuals to come up with paper documentation stating that they had ownership rights to their homes. And if you did not have that, you were not eligible for aid, and you had to rely on the of your community. I can't tell you how many people I talked to who said that their documents or someone they knew blew away, because unless you had a house made entirely of concrete or you had access to a bank with a lockbox that was not affected by the storm, you were not able to access your deeds. However, the situation wasn't much better for people who were able to produce documentation. According to a recent report released by the Office of the Inspector General, FEMA did not safeguard disaster survivors' sensitive and personally identifiable information. Now, this is a document that you can read online, so please feel free to do so. It's only a short 8 to 12 pages, but I'm going to read just one excerpt from it here. It says, a privacy incident occurred because FEMA did not ensure it shared with the contractor only the data elements the contractor requires to perform its official duties administering the TSA program. FEMA provided and continues to provide X, these are contractors, with more than 20 unnecessary data fields for survivors participating in the TSA program. Of the 20 unnecessary data fields, FEMA does not safeguard and improperly releases 6 that include sensitive and personally identifiable information. And I'm gonna group these into 2 major areas. So the first 3 you see here are the applicant's street address, city name, and zip code, all of which make their physical location well known to FEMA and its contractors. This is at risk not only because, of course, knowing where someone lives is often considered to be the most telling piece of data about them, but also because FEMA denied many of the claims made by individuals. So while we don't have any proof of harassment, it certainly opens up the opportunities for FEMA and their contractors to potentially harass individuals who made claims that they deem to be unsuitable. The second group of information has to do with banking information, and it includes financial institution name, electronic funds transfer number, and bank transit number. Of course, opening up all of these disaster survivors' bank accounts to potential misuse. This is particularly concerning as financial resources were so crucially needed by survivors on the island after the storm, and every little bit could make a huge difference in your access to food, medical resources, etc. And so placing this information at risk, both then, but still today, is of significant concern. Although FEMA says that it promises to make changes to its use of data, and it wants to safeguard it, it finds value in safeguarding it, it has not yet done so. And we can only hope that they soon take the steps that they need to do so. This is the other side of the surveillance gap. There are individuals who exist within the surveillance ecosystem, but their information is still placed at risk. Right? In fact, many of us can't escape this kind of dichotomy. We either exist outside what is being surveyed, or we're in this group of people whose information is placed at risk because we need assistance from some sort of public service or government agency. In fact, there are very few people who exist outside the surveillance gap dichotomy, but there are a few, and they are generally the wealthy elite. Perhaps no one embodies this better than Brock Pierce, the leader of Crypto Rico, a recently established LLC on the island. According to a recent article in the Rolling Stone magazine, Pierce, who is smart enough to know that a bunch of mostly rich white males buying up property in a tax haven has a colonialist stench to it, has promised to harness their energy and money to serve Puerto Rico. He says, "We're going to rebuild Puerto Rico with money that we save from the IRS in a Robin Hood fashion." Now, it is hard to explain how many problems there are with this scenario, but I'm going to attempt to pinpoint a few. First off, Brock Pierce has been claimed to be the savior of Puerto Rico within certain communities and frameworks. And this is problematic because he has questionable ethics. You may recognize Brock Pierce. He's former child actor. He was in the Mighty Ducks movies and First Kid. But more recently, he has been linked to Steve Bannon. He and Bannon worked closely together when they sold illegal video game merchandise for a number of years. And he also was more recently linked to a sex ring where young male actors in Hollywood were targeted by a group of established actors. We don't know exactly his role in that community, and I don't say that simply to denounce Brock Pierce, but to point out the kind of ethical situations that he has found himself in, and now that he is placing himself as kind of a savior of Puerto Rico, some of the concerns that may arise from that activity. He also owns a new company called Crypto Rico, which operates entirely on cryptocurrency. And so to explain this really briefly, cryptocurrency works with a system called blockchain, and it essentially is a decentralized banking mechanism where there are no official banks, but there is an open ledger where individuals can see electronically how money is being shifted within the cryptocurrency environment. In theory, there is some sort of identifying name or account number that you can see in the ledger, but it doesn't necessarily point back to you as an individual or to your business clearly. You have to know how to unpack and unravel some of these names to see what's happening. One of the major problems with cryptocurrency is that it cannot be cashed out into real dollars. It only exists as money in this closed ecosystem. And so when they claim that they're going to donate a bunch of the money to Puerto Rico, that becomes quite challenging because they would have to find an organization that accepts Bitcoin. Bitcoin, as many of you may know, is quite expensive to buy into. There's a lot of gatekeeping mechanisms to participate in the cryptocurrency revolution right now. And so it's generally a community that's only open to mostly rich white males, right? Which suggests that there might be a problem trying to provide aid on the island. A closer look at the website of Crypto Rico identifies a handful of partners for this organization. And I went through and I looked at each one of them and found that not one is headquartered on the island of Puerto Rico itself. So this asks some questions. If the money is being shared among these partners, how is the money getting to Puerto Rican residents? Are these organizations taking profit off the top? Are they donating any money at all? This can be hard to determine, as we would all have to buy our way in to get access to this ledger. The last thing that is concerning is that Crypto Rico is buying up property in historic San Juan. Historic San Juan is the biggest tourist attraction on the island and therefore the biggest boon to Puerto Rico's economy each year. So by buying up different parts of historic San Juan, Crypto Rico is actually closing off economic opportunity to the island and privatizing it for their own use. This is further complicated by the fact that they are actually building their own private infrastructure on top of that, including electrical, but also they have talks to build an airport that is only accessible for people who can buy their way in using Bitcoin. So essentially what they're doing is they're walling off Puerto Rico from Puerto Ricans. This is the process of erasure we were talking about. For Brock Pierce and his community, Puerto Rico is an Eden. It is almost a blank slate, an empty land for them to come and settle and reimagine as they so wish. The problem is it's already a community of people who they are intentionally choosing to harm, erase, and exploit for their own gain. So what do we do about this problem? Well, actually, as it turns out, Puerto Rico has come up with a lot of great solutions to its own problems. However, they're not getting much support or press. So I'm going to highlight just a few. The first is Casa Pueblo, which is located in the city of Adjuntas. And you can see a picture of it here. It's a community that runs entirely off solar energy, and it was a safe haven for many individuals during the hurricane. They provided free electrical service to individuals who came to them, and they're also building up communities across the island that rely entirely on solar, with their first one being established just a few months ago. They have made a promise to the island that they will move it to solar energy by 2050, which is pretty impressive, because they're doing this all as a nonprofit organization. This gives us a stark comparison of the solutions that Puerto Rico is coming up with in relation to the solutions that our government is proposing. When we think of Casa Pueblo as an option, and then we compare it to the Whitefish option, we can see many problems. Whitefish would use the fossil fuel industry heavily and would rebuild that infrastructure, which has already caused significant harm on the island. The coal plants are believed to have released toxic ash into the air, particularly in communities around Guayama. And this is affecting many members of the marginalized population, particularly those who identify as Afro-Puerto Rican. Right? In addition, fossil fuels and coal plants don't survive well when they are hit by hurricanes. They have a lot of infrastructure that is made weaker. And while certainly solar panels will be affected as well, we can see that any recovery of solar panels would allow them to be reused and recycled, and that the sun would be a ready-made resource immediately after the storm. Some other solutions I want to point to that are doing great work are La Colectiva Feminista en Construcción, which is a feminist organization that is protesting the increase in violence against women in the wake of the storm. Violence against women has actually statistically doubled, since Hurricane Maria hit, and that is according to reports actually made to law enforcement, so it could be higher. They see the violence against women as intimately linked to Puerto Rico's illegal debt. In the 70s and 80s, a process of privatization began on the island in order to close off public health services. And when they did this, the island issued bonds to raise money for it, But it's not legal in Puerto Rico to issue bonds for services that won't serve the general public. And so now Puerto Rico is billions of dollars in debt, but they've recently ruled that that is not legal, right? So they see that as an act of violence against the island just as much as this violence against women. The third group is PARIS, which is protesting the privatization of education on the island. After the storm, a number of primary and secondary schools were closed because it was believed that their buildings had been damaged or the resources they needed to continue were no longer operational. Many teachers would move from the area, things like that. They also include people who work at the University of Puerto Rico's 11 campuses who offer the only public higher education institutions on the island. However, the Middle States Accreditation Board came a few months ago and they said that UPR was not meeting accreditation standards and that if they did not increase these standards, that the schools could all close as soon as December 31st, 2021. Now, accreditation has never been an issue in Puerto Rico before, and I want to point out that the year after a deadly, disastrous hurricane is an interesting year to pick to talk about increasing accreditation standards. What we do know is that a number of private education companies housed on the mainland are highly interested in moving to the island. They see it as very profitable, and that the closure of the schools would only increase their ability to profit. However, what it would also do, it would wall off educational services to most of the population, making it, of course, a haven for the wealthy elite on the island. Because once again, surveillance is all about erasure. The fourth one here is the Organización Boricua de Agricultura y Ecología. And this actually focuses on farmers on the island who are interested in traditional farming methods or traditional crops. It helps them survive crop loss from disaster, particularly as coffee is such an important crop on the island and it takes many years to grow. It needs shade trees as well as healthy plants underneath them. It makes sure that many of those farmers have the opportunity to continue farming in the face of disaster. And the last group I'm going to mention here is Junta Gente, which is actually a collection of 30 different activist groups on the island who are all unified towards promoting public policy that sees the value in collective action and collective community rather than in the privatization of Puerto Rico's resources. I've chosen these five groups in particular to talk about because they all have social media presences, so you can follow them on Facebook or on Twitter. And also because this provides an opportunity for you also to intervene in what's happening in the island, either by reading and sharing their information, by participating in some of their activist networks, and or by donating money. So why does this matter for us, those of us located on the mainland? Well, there are many reasons, but the first and foremost is that we are complicit in what is happening in Puerto Rico. A recent report released by The Nation found that many of our top and most elite public education institutions are actively invested in Puerto Rico's illegal debt. This includes Yale University, Harvard University, Cornell University, Princeton University, the Berklee College of Music, Brandeis University, Clark University, the University of Chicago, and Marquette University. On top of that, many more of our institutions are invested in the fossil fuel industry, which is only furthering climate catastrophe and placing individuals at risk. I want to point out that what is happening in Puerto Rico right now is not relegated to the island itself, but as climate change continues to affect more and more communities and move its way north, we are going to see these same mechanisms implemented here in our communities as well. This is our opportunity to intervene, to make change, to say that we will not stand for our government agencies and for our corporations making profit off of other people's disaster. Right? We have the ability to do better, and particularly in a room full of humanists, we share the values that can make this possible. So now I ask you, what can we do to make this better? Thank you.
Could actually just expand on that last point about sort of humanist values and the ways that they're enacted and how that relates to specifically the Puerto Rico situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there are a number of different ways to kind of respond to that question. One of the first and foremost is that humanists value people, and we value their right to a good life. And so what we are doing now is we're seeing the slow walling off of that from all of these different corners. I only had the opportunity to highlight a few, but there are actually many more ways in which life in Puerto Rico is becoming increasingly privatized. So something we can do is we can really emphasize the importance of community, community values, community engagement with our research and our projects, and reaching out to organizations that may need help. Many of these groups would be thrilled, I think, to have individuals who are interested in helping them with like media coverage, video recording, transcribing, editing, things like that. So that's an important thing we can do. I also think it's particularly appalling to think about the ways in which our academic institutions are actively profiting off of what's happening in Puerto Rico. And so one other way that we can really promote our values as humanists and the right to education is by talking to our own institutions about these investments and seeing if we can encourage our communities to divest from things that are actively harming other people.
I was wondering, can you go back to the slide with the URL to the project that you had?
Sure. Since it's a Prezi, it will bounce a little bit. I hope that's okay. Here.
Cool. Firstly, I just wanted the URL, but then I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on what this memory bank is and what you see as its kind of goal and its purpose.
Absolutely. The Maria Memory Bank is a collection of stories from individuals who experienced Hurricane Maria. It started off with just a small collection that I participated in partnership with the University of Puerto Rico. I went down roughly 9 months after Hurricane Maria hit and collected a small amount of stories from people who are geographically located across the island. And one of the major goals at that time was to talk about the varied experience of people who lived particularly outside of San Juan, because much of what was being shared was about the big city's experience, even though they were actually one of the least affected communities in many cases. It has now expanded, so I'm excited to have a number of new partners who are setting up story collection centers across the Caribbean, and that will happen this summer into next year, where they will invite people in to talk about their experiences or to bring in an object of importance to them and to highlight why it was so crucial or so emotionally tied to their hurricane experience. We're seeing this as an important step to take because we're finding that many of these stories aren't getting much attention, you're not hearing about them, and that they really, when people can get emotionally connected to the experience that happened on the island, they seem much more compelled to act. It's kind of the magic of storytelling that we're seeing here. As I've met with so many people now, we're also hoping to kind of have a landing page for projects in general that have started collecting these stories, because there are a number of people across the island of Puerto Rico and elsewhere who went around and just asked people about their experiences, and they have all sorts of different records, audio recordings, paper notes, photos. So we're hoping to compile that into a larger resource that can then be accessible. And used not just for educational purposes, but really as a memory archive that is owned and shaped by the people who it serves.
So this is a little bit of a loaded question, but if you could go to the con documents page, I remember seeing a redaction. So when you bring up selective reporting, mm-hmm. are those reports included in redactions, or do they not even make it? And is there a difference between recording and reporting on issues?
Yeah. That's actually a really great question. So redaction is kind of a funny thing, right? So the only access that we have to these materials are the redacted version, and the only access we have to Crypto Rico's ledger, for example, is its list of partners on its page. So every time we're engaging with a material, we kind of have a different ability to access or see what is visible or not visible. And so what I see as really prominent in my work is trying to uncover what is made invisible, either through censorship or through my lack of access to specific resources. I also find it really important. My goal is never to, I never want to fall into the trap of saying that, like, I'm giving voice to someone else, because that's not my role, right? And so I worry about the words like reporting and reporting on, because my role is not to be a mouthpiece for the people of Puerto Rico. My goal is to help them and help them in any way I can possibly do, and then to talk about and make it more well known the kinds of challenges they're facing so that we can then take collective action, right? I was very hurt and harmed by seeing the ways my friends and colleagues were being treated and knowing about their lived experiences, and I felt like something has to be done. And I thought if more people knew what was happening, that they would also feel that way. And that's an important step for us to take, I think.
So that, for me, first, thank you very much. I'm thinking about documenting now and the work that we're doing around folks who are literally under surveillance and the implications of the ethics around that and protecting their privacy and protecting their lives, right? So can you talk a little bit more about in relation to documenting and sensitive information, right, and the stories themselves, how you engage folks, building trust, this ethical care that you approached in capturing these narratives, and then how you actually went about sharing them through, right?
That's a really excellent question. So part of the reason that stories were not collected for 9 months, and then again I'll be going down in a few weeks, is because it was more important to develop relationships with people on the island than to collect their stories. So everyone who participated, they opted in, and they had different ability levels for opt-in. So they could opt in fully and say, like, I give you full rights to my video. Some said, I give you full rights to audio. Some said, you can have rights, but I don't want my name associated with it. And we also, in our consent forms, have an opt-out policy that says at any time, if you decide you no longer want your contribution to be housed in the Maria Memory Bank, we will remove it. Now, that gets a little complicated because digital files could be copied and could be housed elsewhere at that time. But we certainly want to make the step to say we will do the best we can to respect your rights to your own information. It's also a big challenge. I know some of my predecessors worked with the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank, which collected stories of Katrina, and they talked specifically about the challenges of care work and trying to respond respectfully to the trauma that people are feeling. Because even now going down, one of my colleagues, when I was talking to her, they experienced a brief flash of a power outage. And you could just see the fear go across her face, and she said, I'm really sorry, I need to take a minute because I'm so afraid of living again without power for so long. And so something else that we've also tried to do is tell people that they can leave the interview at any time, they can take time, they can come back, they don't have to come back. And one of the strategies we've more recently implemented was this idea of bring in an object you're comfortable talking about, and that way you're not relying upon someone asking you questions that may or may not provoke feelings that you just don't want to engage in that moment. That way you're in control of your narrative, and you're able to determine how the story is shaped.
I'm so interested in these kinds of digital community archives, especially formed in response to not just disasters, but any kind of major sort of social event or movement, because they seem like they have this capacity for not just making things more visible to communities and to people outside of communities, but specifically to the media and to policymakers, people who can make change. So I was wondering if you'd had any kind of luck or any insight on strategies to getting attention to these stories in a more systematic way beyond the communities who have a stake in these stories already?
Yeah, actually that's a really challenging question, but a good one for us to think about. We've kind of shaped up, as we're applying for grants and things like that, kind of a PR strategy for how we're gonna move forward. And I think one of the most effective things we can do is actually reach out to politicians and those in power in Puerto Rico first. As a relatively small community, there's a lot more access to people who would be excited to share these stories. And then we're hoping that through that, then the stories will kind of move through these networks of government agencies. We've actually already had a surprising number of people participate as well who are quite well known in Puerto Rico. One of the individuals I interviewed was a former governor of the island. And another one, I'm going to get his title wrong, but he essentially ran manufacturing for the island for a number of years. And so those are individuals who are already invested, but have the access to the communities that we're really interested in reaching in a political way. And so I'm sure we'll probably be leaning on them for more support and publicity in the future.
Well, I'm sure you can always come up and talk individually after the talk, but let's give another round of applause.